from coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Blowing it sky high is the job of my guest coming up, Dr. Michael Shermer. He is a skeptic. In fact, Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. So he's got to be like the 800-pound gorilla of skeptics. He's director of the Skeptics Society. See, there you go. Monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptics Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology, and the co-host and producer of a Fox Family series entitled Exploring the Unknown. Wow. Dr. Shermer received his B.A. in psychology from Pepperdine, his M.A. in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton, and his Ph.D. in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He's author of several books, including The Science of Good and Evil, Why People Cheat, Gossip, Share, Care, and Follow the Golden Rule, on the evolutionary origins of morality and how to be good without God. Can you be good without God? In addition, he has appeared on many national television programs as a skeptic of weird and extraordinary claims. Tonight, he is here. And now, here is Dr. Michael Shermer. Hey, welcome to the program, doctor.
Good evening.
Good evening. It's great to have you. Where are you?
I'm in Altadena, California.
Altadena, California.
It's right on the borders there of Pasadena.
Oh, okay. I am most curious to know what kind of person a skeptic is, and boy, you're really at the top of the list after having read what I read introducing you here. You're really at the top of the list. So, I mean, what kind of person becomes, I don't know, a skeptic? What kind of guy are you? I mean, do you kick cats?
Really, a skeptic is not
just
a noun
like little,
so much as it's just a way of thinking.
A way of thinking?
Yeah, it's a scientific way of thinking, just looking for the evidence. Checking to see what's the quality of the evidence, how sound is the logic and rationality behind a particular claim. You can't just be a skeptic, because it depends on the claim being made. There are people who claim that the Holocaust never happened, and they're Holocaust skeptics, and I investigated that and ended up becoming a skeptic of the skeptics instead of the claim. So,
have you investigated the 9/11 event?
Yeah. Sure.
Are you at all skeptical of the official explanation of what occurred?
In general, no.
No?
I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming.
Think so?
Yeah.
There's a growing body of people out there, doctor, that I tell you, it's a movement. You know, there was no plane that crashed into the Pentagon, and on and on and on and on.
Yeah. It depends on the particular claim. Again, it's not that conspiracies can't happen. They do. Lincoln, for example, was assassinated by a conspiracy, but Kennedy wasn't, in my opinion. So, again, we have to take them one at a time. You know, where's all the evidence for the plane that hit the Pentagon? Well, where's the evidence of the planes that hit the World Trade Center? They disintegrated, too. The planes disintegrate. There's no body parts, because they disintegrated. That's what happens when planes hit at high speed like that. So, you know, again, we had to just take these one at a time, like the claim we never landed on the moon, and the people, I call them the no moonies.
Yeah.
You know, they have like 20 to 30 different specific arguments that they make. And
so far, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I'm sure we went to the moon. I've had very compelling, strong, impassioned arguments made by people who say we didn't. And, you know, they throw out certain facts, or what they think are facts, but I don't buy it. We landed on the moon. The 9/11 thing is, you know, so you're in safe territory with me so far, but there's, you know, there's a lot of other things. My goodness, a lot of other things that we
could
talk
about. So you asked how I became a skeptic. I actually used to believe a lot of the paranormal stuff. When I was in a graduate program in experimental psychology in the mid-1970s, Uri Geller was all the rage, you know, the Israeli spoon-bending psychic.
Yes.
And I remember seeing articles about him by experimental psychologists, PhDs who had tested him. And these were people that, you know, were really smart and well-educated, and I wanted to be a PhD psychologist. And I thought, well, they say there's something to it. There must be something to it. And there was a paranormal lab set up at UCLA by Thelma Moss, and I thought, wow, okay, those people are really smart and educated, so there must be something to this. And then I saw the amazing Randy, James Randi, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he was doing all the same so-called paranormal tricks that the psychics were doing. And I thought, oh, well, there's something going on here. And Randy made an interesting point that I'll never forget, and that is that scientists are not trained to look for intentional deception. They're looking for unintentional deception by nature, camouflage and
true.
Hidden patterns and things like that. But
true.
Sometimes people just cheat and lie.
Sometimes.
And make stuff up. And
yeah.
Scientists are no better than anybody else at detecting that. So that told me that we can all be fooled. And then the study of illusion and magic showed me how easy it is, actually, and for any of us to be fooled. And then when you get into the study of self-deception, it becomes even more powerful and obvious. How...
I know a number of witches. Witches. Doctor, and they fully believe their power is absolutely real, that the magic they do is very, very real.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever encountered a witch, looked into witchcraft at all?
Mm-hmm.
And what have you found?
Yeah, I think there's a similar effect as with the psychics, that there's a lot of self-deception going on there.
Mm.
They get a lot of reinforcement from their followers that they're doing something very effective, and that makes them think that they are effective. And so what kicks in then is something called the confirmation bias, where we look for and find confirmatory evidence for what we already believe, and we ignore disconfirmatory evidence. And so this is what fuels conspiracy theories. Once you have the conspiracy theory in place, it's easy to find evidence to support it and just ignore all the evidence that doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need much evidence to... reinforce something you really want to believe. So, for example, people that go to psychics, we've tape recorded the readings, and you can count the number of hits and misses just based on the people nodding yes or no, and the hit rate is pretty low. It's like 10% to 15% correct. And in that context, you think, well, why would anybody believe that? But in fact, what you see is them saying, well, it's incredible that
let me just stop you for a second. If going by your own words. You said the hit rate is 10 to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about somebody reciting completely random things...
But they're not random.
Oh.
In fact, they...
So then what are you qualifying as hits?
Well, things like, he got the name of my Uncle George or something like that. Well, when you actually look at the reading, you see the psychic rattling off names. I'm getting a Michael, a Mark, a Mary, a Sam, and so on. And finally, he hits the name, and the person says, yeah, well, George, right, that's my great uncle who passed on. Oh, okay. And then they just feed it back to them and say, no, don't tell me who it is. I'm getting a George here. And the person will actually forget that they told him and then misremember it as being something that the psychic got instead of what they gave him.
Hmm.
Or they'll say things that are true for everybody, like if it's a psychic who talks to the dead, which, by the way, anybody can talk to the dead. It's getting the dead to talk back that's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of just repeating things that are true for everybody. So anybody that's lost somebody will have a keepsake with them, particularly if they go to these readings. A photograph, a piece of jewelry, men who've lost their fathers typically have their father's watch on.
Yes.
That kind of thing. So you'll see the psychics, they say this every reading. I'm getting a watch. He's telling me something about a watch. I don't know what this means. Of course he knows what it means.
Hmm.
You know, so sometimes it's just an outright scam that is being perpetrated on people, and they don't realize it.
But, Doctor, surely we do not understand everything about the human brain yet. We're far from that.
Yes.
Right? So it doesn't it stand to reason that perhaps there are people scattered among the frauds out there who really have developed a portion of their brain that we don't know anything about yet and are able to do things like predict events or take remote viewing, for example, something that apparently most people have a discipline to. Have you looked at remote viewing? It's very interesting.
Yeah, I took a course in it, and
oh.
I taped a whole show on it and so on. Okay, the first part of your statement was correct. There's a lot we don't know about the human brain and the mind. And
indeed.
What is mind and where is consciousness located? Where is the sense of self located? Things like this.
Yes.
But to go from that to, and therefore, isn't it possible that some people have developed some part of their brain? Well, no, that's not a conclusion you can draw from
why not?
A simple unknown fact.
Why not?
Because that would require something completely different. For thoughts to actually leave your skull and traverse across space and go through somebody else's skull into their brain and influence their neurons. We know how neurons work.
Well, so I know it sounds fantastic, Doctor, but have you been looking into the quantum world?
Yes.
Well, have you
in
now?
In fact, I just reviewed this film, What the Bleep Do We Know, for Scientific American.
Yes.
And here's the problem there, is that quantum effects occur at a subatomic level.
Yes.
Neuronal effects of where thought occurs is at a molecular level. It's about three orders of magnitude too big for quantum effects to take effect. They simply can't. It's too big of a leap. It's a quantum leap, if you will.
Well, yeah, but this whole statement you're making is a bit of a quantum leap, isn't it?
Listen. There's a simple physics problem here. These quantum effects, weird as they are, all occur at the level below the size of the atom itself. They're happening down at the size of electrons.
But, Doctor, let's just stop at quantum for a second, okay? I mean, just the fact that these effects occur at all are beyond everything we know. Now, we've confirmed they do occur. These quantum effects do occur. Doesn't that make you scratch your little skeptic skull?
No, because they've been confirmed experimentally.
Yes, indeed so.
They're true.
But we don't know how, do we?
Well, we have some idea of how, and that the fact that there's a level of uncertainty, that itself is built into the fabric of nature. But that doesn't mean that the level of uncertainty leaps across that space gap to a macro level at which neurons occur. So although it's true that the wave function doesn't collapse until it's observed, the moon exists whether it's observed or not because the quantum effects are all washed out at the macro level. So there's no application across that gap.
Nevertheless, we don't understand how the macro communication or the quantum communication, which appears to occur at the speed of, much faster than light, instantaneously, we just don't even begin to understand
that.
That's
right. That's correct.
Okay,
a quantum level, not the macro level at which we live at.
Well,
I mean,
if there's that much we don't know about the quantum process, then, reasonable speculation could go all over the place here.
Okay, here's the problem, is that we have two mysteries. One is, how do the quantum effects occur? And two, how do you explain consciousness from neurons firing?
Okay,
it's possible that the causal arrow goes down to the subatomic level. I think that's too much physics envy. One of the problems of science is that there's too much physics envy. Everybody thinks the big brother physics is the place we have to go to explain something ultimately, and I think that's wrong. I think we have to go in the other direction toward emergence, self-organization, chaos theory, complexity theory. Consciousness as a problem to solve is going to occur at a higher level than neurons firing. It's going to occur at groups of neurons firing, patterns of neurons firing. Mm. Patterns, systems, networks, neural networks, things like that. That's where the explanation for consciousness is going to come from, at a higher level. Biology and systems theory is where the causal arrow should go, not down into the world of physics, but up into the world of systems.
But it just seems to me, though, that the amount we don't understand about the quantum process alone should cause you to be at least a little concerned.
Concerned
from
about
as
what?
Well, from a skeptic's point of view. In other words, if this actually is really happening, it's so impossible, according to everything we understand with physics, right? It's just beyond
Here's the problem, is that you... is that we have this micro quantum level and this macro level of classical physics.
Yes.
And there's two different physics going on, and no one has figured out how to unite the two. Okay?
That should be a problem for you, too. I mean, you can't have two different sets of physics, right?
Art, the fact that there's something we can't explain doesn't open the door for all mysteries to be real.
Well, it does open a lot of doors, though. You know, when you talk to the remote viewers and you do observe...
Okay, but look, there's nothing in remote viewing that needs explaining because there's no phenomenon to explain.
Oh?
Yeah, I've looked into this.
And
what happens when remote viewers are remote viewing is they're doing this kind of psychological game where they're drawing little pictures of things, and then at some point, somebody has to make an interpretation of whether that drawing is a hit or a miss, and that's where the subjectivity comes in. It's not an objective science. It's not where you have a multiple choice and they've statistically gotten a significant number of hits above chance. And when you do set it up like that, there is no effect that needs explaining. It's the same thing with all the psychics. There's simply nothing to explain whether quantum effects are weird or not. They don't have to be employed because there's nothing to explain. When you put psychics under controlled conditions, the effect fades. It disappears. They only operate well when there's this subjective element of what constitutes a hit. So I'm getting a red dress. What does that mean? Oh, the red dress means my mother gave it to me when I was 8. Okay. That's a hit? No. That's too subjective.
No, but if there's a target, for example, of a remote viewer staring at a bridge in Great Britain, and somebody over on the side draws a bridge and the surrounding countryside, I mean, that's a pretty good hit, isn't it?
Well, from what you just described, yeah, but that's not actually what happens.
No,
you read the sort of tabloid equivalent explanations of these things, and it sounds impressive. When you actually read the scientific papers about it, you see where the flaws are, and the effects are not real. The effects are not replicable. This is one of the problems of sort of voodoo science, is where one lab gets an effect and no one can duplicate it, like with cold fusion. It's not impossible. It's entirely possible. It's just that once the announcement was made and other scientists rushed out in their labs to do it and nobody could replicate it, well, within weeks we realized, okay, there's something else going on here.
Nobody said nobody could replicate it. Not everybody could replicate it. Some did replicate it. Others did not. Be fair.
You're talking about cold fusion?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, if cold fusion was real, we'd have cold fusion machines in our kitchens by now, and we don't.
Well,
and
you
so
know, this
the,
jumps
the
into another
is,
interesting
there's something
area.
Wrong with the claimed effect if virtually no one can get it to occur again.
Well, but that wasn't true. There were a number of universities that did and then a number that didn't, and a big controversy, I'll grant you. And I'm not saying that cold fusion is real, although the experiments now have been relegated to Europe, as I'm sure you're aware.
Well, fine, yeah. I mean, even if Americans are too dogmatic or closed-minded or whatever, yeah, people in Japan are trying to replicate cold fusion. There's some people in Europe. If it was real, somebody would have nailed it down by now because it's been, you know, 15 years now. Yeah, 15 years. So when an effect goes on and on like that, like aliens, UFOs, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, you know, decades go by and no one can find a body, no one can find physical evidence, that should be a clue that skepticism is probably most appropriate.
Huh. Well, it is appropriate in many cases. I'm also kind of skeptical about a lot of things, but also very open. And that's where I think the division is between yourself and myself. I'm open to some possibilities, and I don't see how you couldn't be.
It depends what you mean by open and which particular claim you're asking somebody to be open about.
Well, all right.
You can't just be open about everything.
All right. I'm open, for example, about EVP. I bet you're familiar with that, electronic voice phenomena. The voices of the dead being recorded. You're familiar with that,
mm-hmm.
right? That one leaves me open. I'm unable to shoot a hole in what a lot of these people are doing. And are you? You get holes shot in that very easily? You shoot holes in it or what?
Well, voices on machines, the few I've heard, they always sound kind of unclear. It's not amidst a bunch of noise.
Oh.
What is it exactly we're hearing?
All right, there is a good place to stop. It's the bottom of the hour. Hold it right there. What exactly are we hearing? I agree with that. The voices of the dead or a hoax?
Now it begins.
Dr. Shermer, welcome back. I've heard some rather clear recordings, actually, over many, many shows of people. I don't know. These people are pretty good people up in Utah, and they haven't written a book. They're not making any money. They never come on here and sell anything at all. They simply gather together with recorders and go to graveyards, places like that, and get these voices for which there appears no other possible explanation. You rule out, you know, radio stations. They're brand new tapes, never been recorded on previously. So, you know, where do the voices come from? I try and shoot holes in it myself, but the voices are there. Saying relative things, by the way, I might add, contemporary things, showing they're in the moment, that sort of thing. It's pretty wild.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, this is a signal noise problem. It's the same problem the SETI people have in determining whether a signal that's coming from outer space is part of the regular background noise you get, or whether it's a signal like, aliens are sending a significant number or something like that. I haven't heard every single tape anybody's made, but the ones I hear, they're never really all that clear. Usually the claim, it says something like, here, you can clearly hear, he says, whatever.
Yeah.
And when you hear it without that context, it just, to me, sounds like noise. I don't hear it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, some of them, I will grant you, can be very interpretive. But a few times I've heard ones, there's nothing interpretive about them at all. I mean, they're exceptionally clear. Mm-hmm. And
but this is a little bit like the play the Beatles albums backwards and listen for the spooky words.
Uh-huh.
You're going to get that, where random noises occasionally sound like words. Because it's like the face on Mars business. We see faces because that's what we look for, because we're human. Faces are important for us.
Our brain wants to see something we relate to.
Right.
Uh-huh. So, sure, there's some of that. And then would you then also attribute that to all of these millions of UFO sightings? Just millions.
First of all, there aren't millions.
Well, there are, actually.
And second of all, different sightings have different explanations. There's not one universal explanation for all UFO sightings. And most serious ufologists will admit that a good 90% or so of the sightings are explainable.
Sure.
So what we're down to here is looking at that 10% anomalies that are unexplained by traditional methods.
Granted.
So for me, it's perfectly okay to just say, I don't know. We don't know. We don't have a good explanation
but
for
see,
it. Let's just leave it at that.
It's not perfectly okay to say that. It's perfectly okay to say there's 10% we cannot explain. But wouldn't that justify a serious scientific investigation that was a yes?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay, good.
But a serious scientific investigation is not the same thing as aliens landed here.
No, it isn't.
We have what's called the residue problem. There'll always be a residue of unexplained anomalies that the dominant theory at the time cannot explain, and that's just simply the way it is. It's just a built-in limitation. You can't explain everything. So before you overturn the dominant theory that explained 90% of the data, however, your new theory has to explain the 90% and something more. And that's the problem with trying to introduce a new theory. It's not that paradigms can't shift and new theories can't be introduced. That happens all the time.
Yes.
It's just that it has to be a better explanation. And typically, the new explanations that are offered are not better. They're worse. It's just that they claim to explain a few of the anomalies, but they don't explain most of the other stuff.
Well, let's stick with the ghost part of it for a second and drift over toward are you skeptical entirely of life after death, life or consciousness, continued consciousness of any sort after physical death?
Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence for it at all. I think the best chance we have for that ever happening is through computer technology. That is, if we eventually can scan our neural patterns, our networks of information that represent our personalities and memories, ourselves, into computers, silicon is a much more durable medium than the electric meat of our protein, and that can last a lot longer until we have a still hardier medium to download our memories into and into the distant future. But that's pure science fiction at the moment, although there are some people that are working on this.
So you think the only way there'll be life after death is to leap into Microsoft's world?
something like that. Although I'm not sure I'd want to trust a Windows platform for my eternal life, but yeah, it's along those lines.
My eternal life. Microsoft. Oh, well. Have you given it any consideration? I mean, faced with what you as a skeptic, and I guess, well, gee, we could use other words. Are you, would you say you're agnostic, or would you jump?
At this point, I would be shocked if it turned out there's a God in an afterlife. I would be amazed.
Really? Would you?
Yeah,
really?
I'd be sitting there going, oh, my God, I can't believe it. Well, great. I'm very fortunate. I'm happy that there's an afterlife, and, you know, I hope the God is a good God and doesn't.
But you don't believe for one second there is, do you?
No, practically speaking, no. I mean, philosophically, technically, yeah, I can't prove there's no God. I can't prove there's no afterlife. But I don't think there's good enough evidence for it to make a...
Well, what about the evidence there is? I mean, like the Bible, for example. I mean, you know, there's
Bible,
so...
The Bible has written all over it evidence of its human construction. It's socially, culturally bound. It's an edited book. It's obviously an edited book. All biblical scholars agree, virtually all biblical scholars agree that this is the case. It's obviously edited. And the authors are writing against each other. They're arguing amongst themselves. There were books that were left out. Well, why were they left out? Because there was a committee that voted which books should go in, which books should go out. What do you mean a committee that voted? Yeah,
there was.
Yeah.
I know.
So, you know, and the stories are very human. You know, they have written all over them the culture of the times. I mean, the laws of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, for example, are absurd. I mean, you know, that adulterous women should be put to death. That's not something we would obey today. Disobedient children should be stoned to death. Come on, you know, and about not wearing certain clothing fabrics together, not eating certain kinds of foods. These were rules written for people 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of any of that.
In a very different context.
Now, but I don't know that that invalidates the whole Bible and the, you know, the fact that, I mean, you obviously then don't embrace the concept that Jesus walked on earth as a man, huh?
I think there probably was a man named Jesus who definitely was a man who walked on earth. What I cannot make the leap of faith, and that's really what it has to be,
is that he was the son of God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that he was reincarnated, that essentially he was brought back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is not a provable tenet. That is an article of faith. You either take the leap of faith and believe it, or you don't. And if you don't believe it, there's no point in being a Christian. You should be a Jew or something else.
Well...
And this is the problem I see it. The whole science and religion business is that the attempt to use science to prove articles of faith is diverting the whole point of religious faith. The whole point is just to believe, not to prove it. If you could prove it, what's the point of just believing? Everybody should be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim.
How do you characterize those with very strong faith? I mean, how do you personally characterize them?
Well, no different than anybody of a commitment of anything else, like a political commitment. People that are heartily supporting Carrier Bush are no different than people that heartily support Christianity or Judaism. Yeah,
really?
These are beliefs that are arrived at for mostly psychological, emotional reasons. They're behavioral commitments that have to do with how you were raised, the belief of your parents, your peer groups, your teachers, your upbringing, that sort of thing. It has very little to do with science, reason, logic. It's a whole host of psychological factors. So people believe in Christianity for the same reason that they're Democrats or Republicans. That's
wow.
How they were raised.
That's something. You don't think there's a... Well, do you think there's a natural propensity for people to worship? I had a guest.
Yeah, I
had a guest on the show who wrote a book called the God Part of the Brain.
Yeah, I know him.
Do you know Matthew?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very good. His whole
Your show helped kind of give his book a little boost. I think
it did.
I think there's something to that. Although I don't think there's a God gene or a God module specifically. I think it has to do with a larger suite of behavioral psychological things that are going on. For example, the whole idea of using God as an explanation for things, that's one aspect. But most people don't go to church in order to have some explanation for the origins of the universe, and that if you could only teach about the Big Bang, then people wouldn't believe in God anymore, or something like that.
Why do you think it is that even if you go to the deepest jungles of South America, where, you know, the tribe, you find the tribe that has never encountered the rest of modern humanity at all, and they indeed worship something or another,
But that something or another is so radically different than the God
perhaps so.
That we worship.
Yes.
What it is, again, that's just an explanation for something. Let's just take modern Americans. You know, do they go to church on Sunday in order to hear a sermon about the origins of life? No. They go for the social aspects, the music, the culture. Their friends are there. a little moral uplift. And,
that's it,
and
huh?
Just moral sort of homilies for the children.
Sort of a nice tea party for everybody.
In a way, it is. But more than that, it's a social cohesiveness. It's a binding, a bonding of people together. Mm. Religion plays a really important role in uniting people, encouraging cooperation, and this is where my book comes in, of the evolution of morality. Religion plays a really important social role of reinforcing altruistic, pro-social, cooperative behavior. In other words, you should be nice instead of nasty, because we all know humans have a propensity to do nasty things. So religion was the first organized institute on the scene that codified the rules of good behavior into writing, to actually put it into stone, literally. And so what happened was, about 5,000 years ago, before that, all humans were living in small bands and tribes of a couple of dozen to a couple hundred individuals, in which most behavior control could be enforced through informal means, like shunning and guilt and shame and pride and joy and things like that. And most everybody was either related to one another or they knew one another. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to control people's behavior that way. Once populations started to grow to larger sizes, in thousands, tens of thousands, and even hundreds of thousands, there was too much anonymity. People didn't know one another. They weren't related to one another. So why should I be nice? Why should I be cooperative? Why not be an outlier, a cheater? Why not be a freeloader?
Doctor, aren't these all questions that would apply to you, who would doubt all of these things? So without the restrictions applied because of religion or whatever else we could talk about, I mean, why aren't you an outlaw with low moral, or are you? I mean,
well,
what
so,
holds you?
Okay, so what happened was 5,000 to 7,000 years ago is religions and state societies developed in order to codify the rules of behavior for all of us to obey a certain set of rules that make us all better, that makes us as a society better. Mm. So you actually have sort of a group selection going on here in evolution, where groups that are more cooperative and pro-social are more likely to be successful. So we actually have within us, I argue, a tendency to be moral, to be good, if it can be reinforced through culture and society. And that's what these institutions are for. I'm not saying religion's bad. In fact, religion's really good for a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. It's just that it was the first on the scene, so it has a 4,000-year head start over secular institutions. So what happened in the Enlightenment 400 years ago was the thinkers said, look, these are values that are good in and of themselves, even if there is no God, or even if you believe a different God, or you're committed to a different religion, we still hold these values to be self-evidently true, sacred, whatever term you want to use, and those are the founding fathers of our country. So the separation of church and state is actually better for religion, because it protects religion, and it says to everybody who lives here, these are the rules we're going to live by, and I don't care if you believe in God or not, you still have to do this. You still have to be good, and that's good for everybody.
Right. But if you don't believe in all of these things that dictate this control you've talked about, well, then where are you?
Well, that's what states are for, too. States have laws. Actually, states are better at it than religion. Religion just has moral precepts that says you're going to be punished in the next life if you're not good.
So your morality,
what
personal morality,
do is
then
they say you're going to be punished now if you don't
do this. Then your personal morality stems from just the fact that you don't want to break the law and get in trouble?
No. In fact, that's the limitation of religious morality, is it's based on a reward and punishment system. What a secular system of morality says is that these values exist in and of themselves, that people have value in and of themselves. It will be better as a group if everybody does these things.
Uh-huh.
And it's better if you do it now, because there is no next life to be rewarded or punished. The reward has to come now.
Oh, it jumps that far, huh?
I think so. I think it's a higher moral value to be good rather than to not be good, because people have value in and of themselves and it's better for the group, than the religious system, which is based on some payoff in the distant future. I would rather know that you want to be good and nice to me because you value me, as opposed to because you think you're going to get paid off or you have fear of punishment from God. I think it would be a higher moral value if you just held those values in and of themselves, because people have value. And that's the point, I think, of the Enlightenment values that we cherish in this country, that are built into the Constitution. Regardless of your religion, these values are important.
Okay, well, yes, they are. Yes, they are. Although I'm not sure how they're inculcated without religion. Then all you have is fear of punishment in the real world, court sending you away to jail or
whatever.
Because
we're used to religion. Again, religion's had a 4,000-year head start. What the secular system in America is trying to do is to say, we should raise our kids to be this way and have these values, regardless of what religion you are. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not religious at all, these are still good values. And so we've only had, you know, a little over 200 years to think about this and talk about it culturally. But, you know, religion's been doing this for thousands of years, and, you know, they do it pretty well. But we can do it better.
Really? Well, but see, in the modern world, a lot of people have let their religion go. They've lost their religion, basically. And we see a corresponding rise in the crime rate, and particularly the terribly immoral type crimes. We see a big rise in that, and a lot of people see a connection.
Oh, I dispute that. Actually, crime rates are much lower than they've been since the 60s.
Well, I'm talking about a larger span of time. I mean, you know, modern man.
Well, okay.
As religion has sort of slipped away.
Life is much better than it was even 500 years ago. All of us are much safer than we've ever been. Healthier, longer lived, less likely to get mugged, raped, and so on than, say, compared to 500 years ago. It's much better. Thanks to liberal democracy and free markets.
Hmm. Well, it may, of course, depend on which part of the world you're talking about.
Well, yeah, okay. So, but those are theocracies in these awful third world nations. They're either dictatorships or theocracies. Hmm. So it's not that religion is bad. It's that any form of extremism where there's a monopoly of power, whether it's a theocracy, a dictatorship, or whatever, that's the danger.
Mm-hmm.
Religion's fine most of the time. It's extreme religions, just like extreme Marxist cultures are very dangerous. Any kind of extreme monopolistic power, like dictatorships and theocracies, that's the problem.
Uh-huh. Like those we face now in this war on terrorism.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Where there's one of the reasons that Americans are so much more religious than Europeans,
yes,
is that Europeans don't have a free market of religion. We have a free market of religion here. Religions have to compete for limited customers, and they've gotten much better at doing religion. They're more flexible. They're more tolerant. They're more willing to change in order to give people what they need and want, and that's what free markets do. In Europe, the churches all get the same amount of tax dollars, no matter how many people are out there in the pews.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not motivated to try to update their religion, to try to make their religion relevant for the people sitting in the pews, whereas American religions are very vibrant and flexible because they have to be.
Yeah.
That's the value of separating church and state. It's much better for religion. Christians that are in favor of blending church and state, they don't get that. They don't see that it's actually bad for them to do this.
Well, heaven knows. That keeps up. Pretty soon we'll have rap in church. You'll go to Sunday church service, and they'll rap it to you. Maybe that's the future. Dr. Michael Shermer is here.
There's something happening here.
Dr. Shermer, welcome back.
Hi.
Dr. Shermer is a skeptic. Now, Dr. Shermer, let's talk about the power of prayer for a second. We're asking people to pray for this man's wife, Anne, who has, well, you just heard. Now, there have been double-blind studies, Doctor, on the power of prayer. Very well-controlled, scientifically controlled experiments on the power of prayer, in which a group of sick people are prayed for, double-blinds, and then a group of, they're divided, and one's prayed for and one's not, and inevitably, the one prayed for makes a far faster and better recovery. The results have been fantastic and documented. And so I wonder what you say about that.
Wow. Right. Well, on the heels of the story of your friend and, you know, gosh.
That's all right. You go right ahead. I mean, these are scientific studies. And moreover, Doctor, on this program, I did a series of experiments. I'm going to add to the equation here a little bit. And in these experiments, young and foolish years ago, I did, oh, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 regarding several regarding people's health, and then a few that produced rain in areas that had absolute drought and no forecast for rain. We did some amazing things. Not in the name of God. We just did mass concentrations. And so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, either leave God's name in this or not, if you wish. But I'm concluding, and many others are scientifically, that there is a mass consciousness effect, and that it's real. And there's quite a bit of science behind it. Princeton is doing some very good things with that. Duke University is doing some things. I mean, there's some serious people doing things with this.
Mm-hmm.
So can you, as a skeptic, say, oh, baloney?
Yeah. Well,
was
there's
that a
also
yes?
been some really good critiques of the methodologies that I just summarized in an article for Scientific American that'll be out next month.
I'm listening.
And there's numerous problems, but let's just start with the theological problem that I find most problematic. And that is, does God need to be reminded that somebody is ill? An all-knowing, all-powerful being doesn't know that Mr. Stryber's wife just collapsed. He doesn't know this, and he has to be reminded or asked. Or
What does it mean? I took it beyond that. You take it beyond that. Whether it's in God's name or it's simply a function of the human brain in concentration.
Okay, so let's say it's not God, that it's, you know, tapping into some universal spirit or something like that.
Okay.
Okay. Here's the other problems. When In the prayer studies themselves, it's never explained exactly what the dosage is. That is, are 2 20-minute prayers the equivalent of 1 40-minute prayer? Is it better to have a priest praying than a parishioner? Is, you know, a priestly prayer worth 10 parishioner prayers? This would be like saying, you know, extract of seaweed cures cancer. Okay, well, what was the dosage? I don't know. Where'd you get the seaweed? I don't know. Well, what kind of seaweed was it? I don't know. It just doesn't really tell us anything.
Nor does it disprove.
But the more serious problem methodologically is, this was pointed out in several studies in Lancet, in which they did an analysis of all the significant studies you referenced. And that is, there's no consistency across the studies. So, like, for example, in the famous, the two famous studies with heart patients, they measured lots of different things. 20, 25 different measures, outcome measures, were taken. Mm-hmm. And in the difference between the prayed-for group and the non-prayed-for group was insignificant for all but, I think, six of the measures. No, I think it was 4 of the measures. And in the other study, it was 4 different significant measures that were significant. The ones that were significant in one were not the ones that were significant in the other. So there was no consistency across the studies, no replication across the studies. That was another a methodological problem there. And so these things are fraught with, well, methodological difficulties, to say the least. And it sounds nice, and it is a warm human social thing to do, to care for our friends and loved ones.
Yes.
And that's fine. And, you know, to know that you are a member of a community and a family with people and friends that love you, that does make a difference.
But your own personal view would be that prayer is just a waste of time.
So, well, intercessory prayer, that is where the person doesn't know they're being prayed for.
Yes.
And you're asking something or someone out there to intercede.
Yes.
On some higher spiritual plane or dimension or some such thing. Oh, yeah.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, I would say that there's, at present, there's no evidence that that really does have an effect. Sorry.
But there is some evidence. I mean, you may have problems with the methodology, but there is some evidence. That's actually the problem there, Doctor.
There are some really big studies being done, as you said, at Duke and Princeton, and there's one at Harvard that's being done, and that's good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing tests.
Why do you think people...
But the harder problem is, what is it that's being tested? What do you mean by prayer?
Why do you think that the studies would have reached these prestigious universities if there wasn't significant reason for somebody with an awful lot of education to say, hey, there's something going on here?
Well, because...
Maybe.
Well, a couple things. One, we live in a very religious country, and two, there's a huge movement to unite science and religion, and it's largely driven by the Templeton Foundation. And this is one of those interesting social phenomena where you follow the money. A lot of these studies, most of them, in fact, are funded by Templeton money. And that's okay. This is a free society, and Templeton can do whatever he wants.
I was going to say, so what? I mean, maybe science and religion are going. Have you considered the possibility that, boy, it would be a rough day for skeptics, I know, but that science eventually is going to be able to prove some of this? Then what?
Well, okay, we can deal with that. But
can you?
No, but what does it mean to say something is supernatural?
So.
As soon as science offers an explanation, what science is doing is offering a natural explanation. As soon as it has an explanation, it's no longer part of the supernatural. So,
okay,
if you expand the sphere of science into the unknown, the supernatural and the paranormal are simply going to disappear.
They just
won't exist anymore.
Well, maybe what you're scoffing at now, though, will become fact.
That's right. If it does, fine. But we would want to know, what's the mechanism? What do you mean by prayer? Do you mean thinking positive thoughts? Do you mean actually asking something else to intercede?
I want to leap beyond just prayer if we can. Not that there's a thing in the world wrong with prayer. We're asking for it for Anne, in fact. I'm saying that there's an awful lot of consciousness work being done at these universities that is absolutely astounding. I'm going to give you another one, all right? So we move away from God for just a moment. This study with computers, or eggs, they're called. I'm sure you're at least a little up on that, aren't you?
On the which? I didn't hear you.
Well, what they're doing at Princeton with this large computer that's then connected to a whole bunch of other computers geographically scattered around the globe. They report back to the mama computer, and they have seen incredible things like the needles going right off the charts a few hours before 9/11. They're doing all this mass consciousness stuff. You're not up on that.
No, I don't know that.
Oh, darn.
Particular study, sorry.
Oh, darn, darn.
They can't know everything.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. Well, it's incredible stuff. I mean, it's all sort of in the same alley, this mass consciousness kind of thing, where there are some prayer results that are startling to I think, even scientists.
We could certainly use the Internet as an example of this sort of networking of human individuals across the globe, certainly.
Yes.
Is there some other form of energy that we don't know about that acts like the Internet?
Mm-hmm. The
so-called 100th monkey phenomenon or something like that I do know something about. No, I don't think so. I mean, not that we know of. What we have are a lot of weird, anomalous things that happen that we try to explain. And since science can't explain all these things, we then turn to supra-science or paranormal explanations or whatever. I think it's okay to just say, you know, this is a really weird, spooky thing, and we don't know what the explanation is, and maybe someday we'll have a natural explanation. But before we say something is out of this world, let's first make sure it's not in this world. Let's try to use the best science we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly agree with that. I'm just suggesting that some of the things, are you familiar with the Brookings Institution study that says that, you know, if aliens landed, why, you might not want to tell the populace because they couldn't take it?
I completely disagree with that. I think it's absurd.
Okay.
I think the public would be fine with it. I think it would be a news story for, in other words, the SETI deals with this. What if we actually found a signal?
That's right.
You know, what would happen? Would the stock market collapse? And I'm like, no, I don't think so. I think remember back in 96 when the Mars rock story hit and, you know, that they'd found life on Mars and this
right.
little meteorite. Okay, this was a huge news story, and Clinton made a big speech about it, and it was very exciting. We all got tons of interviews for a couple of days and cover of Time magazine, but within 2 weeks it was a dead issue. There was nothing more to report. And, you know, business went on as usual, and I think that would be the case. I don't think the government's covering up aliens in Area 51 because they're afraid to tell the public because the stock market would collapse. I think that's just baloney. I don't think any of that would happen.
You don't think there's any chance that our government perhaps has had contact with aliens and might have craft or bodies or something? You think that's just all...
I think that's probably not the case. I mean, does the government lie to us about things? Yeah, they sure do.
Oh, really? You admit that.
They do.
Uh-huh.
And I think that probably explains a lot of these anomalies. I mean, the line about national security secrets, which we know goes on all the time, that can account for why information has big blocks of blacked out type on it, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, then, I mean, what do you think? The government would just say, hey, you know, guess what? An alien did land, and we've got visitors, and, well, here's one of them. Let's bring them out with the president here.
Yeah, I think somebody would. It's hard to keep people quiet. This is the problem. There's two problems with conspiracy theories, and I heard this from G. Gordon Liddy when I was on his talk show, and I figured, well, this guy knows more about conspiracies than I do because he was in on one, and so I'll ask him. And he explained to me that the problem with conspiracy theories are twofold. One, competence, and two, the leakage problem. One, competence. Government officials are generally fairly incompetent. Bureaucrats are generally unable to pull off their jobs, let alone elaborate conspiracies.
Mm-hmm.
And two is the leakage problem. You can't get people to keep their mouths shut. People just like to talk, and the idea, and the bigger the conspiracy, the more people would have to be involved, and the chances of keeping them from going on Larry King Live and next on Oprah and so on, book contracts, television shows, and so on, that would be so appealing.
How do you suppose we ever kept the secret of the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project? We did keep that
secret.
Well,
we didn't. I mean, secrets were pirated out and given to the Soviets. We know this. This is a huge problem.
We're talking about much later. I'm talking about during the discovery and construction phase.
Even there, they were sneaking stuff out. Even in still in the 40s.
Back during the construction phase of the atomic bomb?
Well, toward the end.
But I mean, the Manhattan Project was a successful secret.
Yeah, and boy, they had to go to elaborate means to do that.
Well, they did, but they did do it.
For a while.
Yeah. All right, hold on. Smart guy. But he's skeptical, very, 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 very skeptical. And I wonder, Doctor, are you at all skeptical of why we went to war with Iraq?
Yeah, of course I am.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I think...
good and consistent, at least.
I think it's pretty obvious that there were a lot of political, economic reasons that really have nothing to do with terrorism. I think most people... at least that are not committed Bush supporters, recognize that fact, that at some point we were all supportive of Bush going into Afghanistan. He had 90% approval ratings at that point and so on. And then the diversion, the left sharp left turn into Iraq, I think obviously was a mistake in retrospect. At the very least, it would be nice to hear from the administration something along the lines of, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that's what the evidence showed about weapons of mass destruction and so on. Obviously, we were wrong. Mm-hmm. So let's just try to make the best with what we have now. Mm-hmm. At least that would make the American people feel like, okay, you know, they're leveling with us. It's the problem we talked about earlier, do governments, you know, lie? Yeah, they do, and we all know it, and that's what makes it so difficult to get behind the administration when they're incapable of admitting any kind of wrongdoing or even just mistakes, not moral mistakes, just, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Even Kerry voted for the war at the time because it seemed that's where the evidence was. And to have a leader who's incapable of subtle nuance and saying, I was wrong, that's kind of scary. We really need, in a complex world like this, we need a leader capable of saying, I changed my mind. I have new evidence, and I have a different opinion
now. Well, there's a political word for that. They call it waffling, you see, and you can't waffle.
Yeah, flip-flop,
you can't
right.
be wrong.
Right.
Right? That's very important.
There's a good article in today's New York Times Magazine about the fate of George W. Bush, and he shows, the article shows that when you have a deep faith commitment that you're absolutely right no matter what, then you cannot be steered in a different direction no matter what the evidence is. And that's scary. That's not what you want in a political leader in a complex world that's always changing. You need somebody who's flexible. There's plenty I like about George Bush, but this is a serious problem.
You know, that's really cool.
And a political leader.
You know, before I even asked, I got so much more in terms of an answer to that question than I expected. Only 40% of the audience hated you before I asked that question. Now, 60% of the audience hates you.
Oh, okay.
You've made a definitive and strong political statement that I didn't expect.
Well, it's on a specific question, though.
It sure was. I mean,
George Bush's economic policy, I agree with that. I'm a economic libertarian and a social liberal. I mean, I'm what I would call a secular Republican.
A secular Republican.
Just leave God out of it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Just run the country like a corporation. Just, you know, run it as a business. It's a political organization. It's not a religion. I don't want to vote for a religious leader. We're voting for the commander in chief, not the chief chaplain of America. Okay, we have plenty of chaplains. We need a political leader who's savvy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all the politicians have to understand the amount of faith out there and be careful with it.
Well, of course,
right?
You'll never get elected if you don't tread that fine line. I understand that, but.
What about people? People seem to have so many talents for which there is really no explanation. Water witching is certainly one of them. Maybe there's even a little science perhaps mixed in with this. I don't know. But it does seem that some people are blessed with the ability to find water. Have you ever looked into that?
Yep. There's been a number of really good controlled tests of water witchers in a laboratory where there are buckets of water, and these are opaque boxes in which inside there are big 5-gallon jugs of Arrowhead water or just empty jugs of Arrowhead water. Mm-hmm. And the water witcher, the water dowser, has to determine which boxes have the water and which don't when they can't see through the boxes.
You're telling me they couldn't?
And they can't. Mm-hmm. No, they never do. They have never once been able to do this. Under lots, not just boxes, sometimes they have pipes running through. Some pipes have water, they don't. The experiments get more or less elaborate, but they are never able to find the water greater than randomly guessing. Yeah.
No kidding. So yep. It's just not a thing to it?
No, there's not. I mean, people can find water, but that doesn't mean that they're doing it by that effect. It's just that there's a lot of groundwater, and if you make enough guesses, you're going to be right.
Would the word agnostic or atheist more likely describe you, honestly?
Well, I'm not crazy about labels. Agnostic is fine.
But they have meaning. These words have meaning.
That's right. They do. And that's why agnostic is a good word. It was coined in 1869 by Thomas Henry Huxley, who meant by it that God is an insoluble problem. Science will never be able to determine whether there is or not. So
you like agnostic?
Yeah.
There's hope then, I suppose. if most humans...
I don't mean by agnostic, I'm waiting for more evidence because it could go either way.
Oh.
I mean that I'm saying there will never be any evidence to support it, to support the claim that there is or is not a God one way or the other. It's not a scientific testable problem. It's a faith...
At the moment.
At the moment.
Uh-huh. If most humans in the world were colorblind... And only a very small percentage of them actually had the ability to see color. Do you think that would mean that color doesn't exist?
Wouldn't the world say there'd be people like you
saying this color thing is baloney? Look, 90 something percent see what we all see, black and white. These people claim they see color. It's stupid to even imagine that could be true.
Right, but most people don't believe in God because they've actually seen God or heard the voices or whatever. I mean, this whole idea of the God module that we talked about before, the God module in the brain, I think that goes a ways toward explaining some of the religious visionaries of the past, where they hear voices, they see angels, the angels speak to them, God speaks to them, that sort of thing. But most people, when you ask them why they believe in God, they don't say, because God spoke to me one night, or you know, I saw a vision and the Archangel Michael appeared in my bedroom. You know, that most people, that's not what they say.
Oh, well, you'd be surprised how many callers I would get who would say that.
Well, Art, you have a selective audience. I mean, in, you know, sociologists of religion, they survey people like hardly anybody. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny percentage. Most people believe because they were raised that way.
Uh-huh.
Why are you a Catholic? Because I was raised a Catholic. Why are you Protestant? My parents were Protestants.
Oh, yes.
Same reason why most people are Democrats or Republicans. They, you know, it's a culture that in which they're raised. Their family, their friends, social circle, their peer groups, and so on. Few of us, and, you know, scientists included, don't arrive at these beliefs for rational, logical, scientific reasons. They arrive at them for other reasons.
Would you go as far as to scoff at faith?
No.
No.
I mean, what would be the point? It's our point here is to understand why people believe.
So then you're a compassionate skeptic then.
I'm a passionate scientist.
No, I said compassionate.
Oh, compassionate.
Yeah,
oh, sure.
Compassionate skeptic.
Yeah, of course. I'm interested in knowing why the world works the way it does, and that includes why people believe what they believe, including why scientists believe what they believe. I mean, scientists believe all sorts of wacky things, too.
Oh?
I wrote a chapter for my Why People Believe Weird Things book. I wrote a new chapter for the second edition called Why Smart People Believe Weird Things. That's the interesting problem. And the answer, in short, is that smart people are better at rationalizing beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons.
Hmm.
So scientists, professors, academics, and so on are really good at justifying, say, political beliefs, social attitudes, and so on that they hold, that they really, they didn't arrive at those beliefs for any sort of rational, academic, logical, scientific reasons. They arrived at them and hold them for all kinds of emotional reasons, but they're smart, so they're good at justifying them and giving reasons for the beliefs.
Let me try one out on you here. It's interesting. It's sort of something that a lot of people believe right now, but mainstream everything is in the middle of denial about it. There's this amazing thing going on in the world now where if you look at the North Pole and you look at the South Pole, Doctor, they're melting.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually melting.
Mm-hmm.
And this will potentially, according to a lot of people who are studying such things, have a gigantic effect on the ocean currents,
mm-hmm.
which in turn then will have a gigantic effect on our weather.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden we're beginning to see all these articles written by perhaps some would call them people on the fringe saying something really awful is going to happen with regard to our environment. What do you think about that one?
You mean global warming in general? Is that what you're
I guess, yes,
at?
I guess.
I think there's really good evidence that global warming is real and happening at a fairly specific rate, and that whether it's human-caused or naturally caused or a combination thereof is not as clear. There's not as much scientific consensus on that, although in the last year or so there's been more evidence to show that humans have had some role, although it looks like sunspot activity and other natural phenomena also probably play a part in that. We know now from climatological studies that the environment in, oh, say, the past 100,000 years or so has taken some wild swings,
mm-hmm.
huge swings, that could have dramatic effects, and not in the course of thousands of years, but dozens of years.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the matter of days like in that film, but in the course of a few years to a few dozen years, you could get some pretty wild swings.
Now we're starting to see these suggestions that there's a kind of a break point and an acceleration at this break point that occurs. It gets past a certain point and it becomes runaway. And some are now starting to say that switch has now been thrown and the process of the acceleration into what you just talked about is actually underway now.
Maybe. I'll tell you one thing that kind of put me off on a lot of the extreme environmentalism movement that began in the 70s when I was in college was I believed all those doomsday claims that were being made by, like, Paul Ehrlich, for example, about the population bomb. And by the 1980s, there'd be no more oil, no more rainforest, and so on. And none of that happened. And so that kind of turned me off on some of that. I thought, you know, these extremists on the environmental movement, they were really wrong.
But a lot of it did happen. A lot of rainforest was burned.
Well, yes, that's right. I just think the problem is
the
more long-term
kept commenting on
and
it.
Systematic.
Mm.
And but I'm optimistic we can still do something about it. I don't think we're doomed. I think we can change our ways.
All right. I want to try out another line of thought on you while I still... We're going to turn you over to the audience at the top of the hour. That will be an experience for the both of us. But right now, I want to ask this. In medicine, it's pretty well known that if you give somebody a sugar pill, you've got a alarmingly high chance of actually achieving a cure. An alarmingly high chance of achieving a cure. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Well, not for everything. I mean,
not cancer, but other things. Don't push me there. Not for everything. I agree, but for a lot of
The placebo effect is well established.
Yes. So then I'm going to ask you this: Where's the harm? If a psychic says something to somebody, or if they come to believe something is true, and so they proceed with that faith toward their objective, what's the harm? If it actually helped them, no matter the mechanism that produced the drive that got them to go there, then where's the harm?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it depends. In some cases, there may be no harm. In other cases, I think it's better to live in a world of reality rather than non-reality. In some cases, doing drugs is maybe great for stress. Drinking may be great for dealing with some problems, but it has other long-term consequences that are not so beneficial. Paying a psychic, $3.95 a minute when it's just a scam ripoff, you'd be better off going to a professional trained psychotherapist or counselor, or just talking to a good friend who won't charge you anything.
Well, maybe, but again, if you believe that what that psychic says is true and the placebo effect is constant in this area, and I believe that it is because it's don't you? I mean, don't you believe the same percentage of placebo would occur with believed words from a psychic as believed words from a doctor followed by a sugar pill? I mean, how much difference is there? Not much.
Most of the stuff psychics tell people is just so inane and it's just so stupid. If you burn a purple candle, your career will go better. No, it doesn't have anything to do with burning purple candles. It has to do with you making an effort.
I know that. The context of the question is that the person burning the purple candle does believe that.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be better? I'd rather they go for somebody like a Tony Robbins, who is at least telling them to set goals and some practical things rather than, pure foo-foo stuff.
But where's the harm? And maybe I could even argue that it's a high enough percentage that there's a benefit.
Well, and so, for example, somebody, let's say, is suffering loss, death, and grief. They've lost a child or some such thing. They go to a psychic.
Mm-hmm.
Are they really going to be able to deal better with grief by pretending that their loved one is not really dead, but is still alive on a different plane and sitting here in the room with us?
Yes, if they believe that, if that's really
what they
believe... Yeah,
but I don't think that's the case. I don't think
better off. Maybe you don't, but if that person believes that, then they go away comforted. So
maybe for a while. I don't know that that really has long-term healing effects.
Well, probably not on you.
Yeah, and I see the point you're making. I'm just not comfortable recommending that somebody pretend something is real. I'm not even comfortable with doctors lying to patients. I mean, if there's some possibility that they may get better, then by all means, tell the patients that. But I'm not comfortable with doctors lying to patients. It's a form of deception, and deception has long-term consequences that are difficult to see in the short run.
So then little Johnny with terminal cancer, you'd have the doctor go, listen, Johnny, you're toast.
Well, no, there's more humane ways to handle it and deal with it. And cancers do go into remission. Doctors are never certain.
I mean, what if a doctor believes that, and for good reason, I might add, maybe even verifiable reason, that a patient who believes that they will get better by a giant percentage, will. And a patient who thinks they're going to die is damn well going to die. And if there's a difference in belief, then it's on the doctor's side.
I see your point. It's a good point. However, what about the patients who are told this by the doctors and they die anyway? So what are they supposed to think is
well,
their time?
Well, for one thing,
that
they don't complain.
I had bad thoughts.
They don't bitch about it.
Well, that I had bad thoughts, and the family members think, oh, we didn't pray hard enough, or we didn't think positive enough thoughts. It's our fault he died, because the doctor said if we thought positive thoughts or if he thought positive thoughts, his cancer would go away, and it didn't. I mean, most...
Well, then there's God's will. I mean, that's always what
most of these diagnosed
God's will.
Terminal cancers, the patients die. We only hear about the miraculous recoveries because, well, they're so unusual. But, in fact, most people that get these kinds of cancers, they just die, no matter what new therapies they're trying, whatever placebo effects, whatever positive thinking, none of that has any effect. They just die. We don't hear about them. But the family members who are told, well, you know, you should have done this or you should have done
maybe
that.
Maybe it works a little more on the margins, doctor. In other words, you're taking terminal cancer as your example. There's an awful lot more that's in between.
Clinical depression, headaches, things like that are more subjective, and there the placebo effect has a much stronger effect.
Listen, I've got to take a break here. We are indeed at the top of the hour. And when we come back, Dr. Michael Shermer is going to be all yours. He's a pretty bright guy, so you better come well armed, I would suggest. From the high desert in the middle of the night, I'm Art Bell.
World was on fire. Would desire make foolish people live. I never dreamed that I'd meet somebody like you. And I never dreamed.
Once again, Dr. Michael Shermer. Dr. Shermer, are you at all skeptical of our government's claim to be able to take all of this horrid nuclear waste that we have and put it in a mountain about just not that many miles away from me called Yucca Mountain, and that the claim is that they can keep it safe for tens of thousands of years if they have to. Are you skeptical of that at all?
Yeah, I haven't really investigated that at all. From what I've seen on some 60 Minute pieces and so forth, it looks like it's a bigger problem than they thought it would be.
Yeah.
I don't know. Leaving that to bureaucrats seems like a bad idea. I would put it out for bid in a marketplace of people that specialize in that sort of thing, and you know, sort of let the best contractor.
So anyway, you are skeptical.
Yeah.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer. Hello.
Yes, hello, Art. I'm a great fan. I wish you had a TV show. Dr. Shermer.
Hey.
I'm as big a skeptic as you are, and I agree with 99% of everything you said. And I even share your religious and political views to the extent that you express them. But now some things are pretty hard to explain. For example, during one of the solar eclipses, it was going to be visible 100% down in Mexico. Astronomers, as you can imagine, and just amateur astronomers, professionals, and TV cameras of high quality recorded a multiple sighting of UFOs that were physical. They reflected sunlight. There was shadow underneath them. It was thousands of witnesses. And pictures from different angles, all right, observed the phenomenon. There were between, I don't know, 10 and 25 of them doing maneuvers that are just impossible by modern aircraft of any known kind. I mean, that might not be secret.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you expand, and in a related sighting, well, not a related sighting, but
where are you going with this? Are you wanting to ask him how can you ignore something so universally seen, photographed, and witnessed? Is that the question?
Yeah, exactly. I mean...
Okay, all right. Well, then hold on. Let him answer the question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know about the one in particular that you're bringing up. I haven't heard of that one. But in general, it's a good question because a lot of these things are not just the planet Venus or a weather balloon or a visual hallucination or illusion or something like that. In fact, we have a very interesting UFO that flies over our house every New Year's Day morning at 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
It's the stealth B-2 bomber that flies from Edwards Air Force Base right over the Rose Parade, right down Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena, and then it circles around right over my house and does another flight down the boulevard.
Sure. I went to the Super Bowl. They flew the B-2 right over.
It's really an amazing thing to see. It is so unbelievable.
Stealth bomber.
That if we didn't know about stealth technology, out in the desert and it was kind of dusk and you weren't quite sure and you believed in UFOs and you saw that thing, you would definitely think it was some sort of UFO. I mean, it's really weird looking. It just looks like a black hole in the sky, triangular hole in the sky. It's pretty spooky. But we know what it is in that case. So what are the chances that the other things we don't quite know what they are represent aliens from another planet or just another form of type of stealth aircraft that we just don't know what's going on in our top secret government? You know, I mean, these things do happen.
Do you think SETI is a waste of money?
No, I think it's... I think they have. It's a long shot that they'll succeed, a real long shot. However, it's so cheap to do compared to where else we spend our money. I think it's well worth the cost. In any case, it's not a government-funded thing anymore. It's all privately funded, so
that's right.
People can do whatever they want with their money. And, you know, if Paul Allen wants to, fund that like he did the Spaceship One, I think it's terrific.
Would you be against government money being used as any part of that effort?
Well, you know, as a libertarian, I tend to be against government programs. However, there's a lot of big science that can't be done without it. So, I suppose I'd be in favor of it, but, you know, it would be a little bit inconsistent of me to do so. It's so cheap compared to, say, you know, gee, the cost overrun on a single aircraft,
yes,
you know, used for war. I mean, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is such a worthwhile project. And success would be so spectacular. It would be wonderful if we had success in finding an extraterrestrial intelligence.
I certainly agree with that. All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Dr. Shermer. I would like to propose an experiment. I'm sure both of you are familiar with the curse of the Bambino.
Well, the Sox got through tonight.
I say the odds of them going on to win the series is astronomical.
Yeah.
I'd like to propose one of Art's mass consciousness experiments.
Okay.
No. Do you have anyone? No. The answer is no. I'm not doing them for, you know, I have a serious talk with you about that maybe, but in the meantime, caller, no.
Okay.
No dice.
The Yankees are evil.
Good try.
The Yankees are evil.
Goodbye.
Steinbrenner doesn't deserve another pennant. I like it. I like this guy. Who's this guy?
He's a good guy, but...
Come on, everybody. Let's root for the Sox.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Shermer.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Art Bell.
Hi there.
Yes,
all
this is Tony. I'm calling just outside of Statesville, North Carolina. I'm a truck driver.
Okay.
I don't have any PhDs or MDs or anything, but I wanted to ask the fine doctor if he can explain the origin of the Big Bang as far as who did it, what did it, and how it was done, if he doesn't believe in God.
Well, fine. The Big Bang is indeed a mystery, a big mystery, Dr. Shermer, that all of this that we know of, apparently, according to science, came from something smaller than a quark.
Yeah, it's a great question. You certainly don't need a PhD to ask, what came before the first beginning and what created the first cause and so on?
That was a question.
Of course, you could ask that about God. Who created God? What came before God?
Yeah, but you don't believe in God. So
and theologians
shift it back to something.
Hold on.
No, this isn't fair. I mean, you're shifting it out of the realm of, after all, materially, this did
happen. Okay, all right, fine, fair enough. We have some explanations of what might have triggered the Big Bang.
Oh.
So one explanation is a collapsed star, a collapsed black hole in another universe. That could have been the trigger. There might be multiple universes. I know you know about this because you've had guests on your show talking about this.
I do.
Multiple bubble universes. Our universe is just one of many universes, perhaps an infinite number of universes. And in any universe that has the kinds of laws of nature that we have that create atoms, which lead to the creation of stars, which leads to stars to collapse into black holes, which might create other universes, are more likely to survive. That is, they're more likely to launch other universes. So,
then you really are buying into all these possibilities.
I think it's very possible, yes.
Uh-huh. Then why be in denial, then, about interaction between them, which is perhaps what we're talking about in so many of these areas?
Yeah, that's slightly different. Those are like parallel universes or a quantum sort of Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics
where
you know, all possible choices are real. That's a slightly different model than the one I just described, but that's also possible. I definitely don't deny that. It's entirely possible.
But it might be the answer to an awful lot of what we observe is simply not possible. I mean, if we're observing
not ESP stuff, but quantum effects, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, well, that's where science and metaphysical may go and get married.
So, you know, when the individual photons go through the slit in the double slit experiment, and they appear to interact with other photons that aren't really, they don't seem to be there in our universe. Yeah, maybe they're there in some other universe. That's possible.
Mm-hmm. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Shermer. Hi.
Yeah, Art.
Yes, sir. Turn your radio off, please. Off.
Okay, it's off.
That's good.
All right. Listen,
now.
I wanted to bring the NDE subject up to
good.
It. There's a Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that did a study of about 20,000 patients who went through that, and one of the things that popped out to me was that people who are blind from birth,
yes,
blind from birth, when they had an NDE, could see and describe down to the detail of colors of a shirt, jewelry, facial expressions, etc.
Yes, I interviewed such a person just a couple of weeks ago, so... Fine, Dr. Shermer, let's talk about it. Let's talk about near death, the thousands of people who have come back and they've been interviewed and they've related so many similar things. The evidence is beginning to be very large, sort of a mountain of anecdotal evidence that does add up to something. What do you say?
Yeah, real effect. There's definitely something going on with out-of-body and near-death experiences.
Oh?
The question is, what? Do these things represent something out there or inside our heads? And I think it's a inside-the-head phenomenon. I think it's a kind of experience that has to do with oxygen deprivation to the brain, shock and trauma, the kind of thing that happens in surgeries, near drownings, car accidents, heart attacks, that sort of thing that people experience. Part of the problem is we don't have a full, really satisfactory explanation for it. We have some ideas, the oxygen deprivation as being one. But because we don't really quite understand what consciousness is, we're not going to know what an altered state of it is, whether it's a hypnotic state or a near-death experience or out-of-body experience or whatever.
Okay, all this.
So this is one of those areas where there's still some mystery.
I'll say. I'm glad to hear you say that. There are things that you find mystifying about. And what about the commonality of the experiences? I mean, that's
got
to
be
shocking.
Our brains are all structured in the same way. They operate in the same neurotransmitter substances. They all have synapses, and the neurons talk to each other the same way. So, of course, we're going to have common experiences.
Huh.
You would expect that. And culture determines these things in large part. I mean, you know, I think the whole alien abduction experience, the whole phenomenon, is a cultural experience. It has to do with the fact that we live in the age of science and science fiction and space exploration. And people 500 years ago, they had similar experiences, but they were describing demons, incubi and succubi, because they lived in a demon-haunted world. We live in an alien-haunted world. The brain phenomenon is all the same.
All bad dreams?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the culture tells you how to interpret those dreams. The culture tells you what the iconography of the dreams are supposed to mean.
So you don't think there's anything to any abduction?
No.
Period.
Well, I think there's something to it. I think it's fascinating as all get out that people are having these experiences, but I don't think they're any different than the demon-haunted experience.
Well, you know, I've
had.
Interviewed people like Travis Walton.
Uh-huh.
You probably know that case.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And I interviewed Travis's boss, and there were others who, you know, they all saw this happen. They've taken lie detector tests. The story is pretty detailed, very specific, and backed up by everybody who was there. Do you look into that?
I don't know that much about the Walton case. I mean, I saw the movie, and I've read a few bits and pieces about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm skeptical of the lie detector test also. People can, it's really easy to beat the lie detector test. And if you really believe your story, then you're going to, of course you're going to pass the
lie
detector test.
Well, those people would, yes. Yeah. But to cheat, I've had experts on lie detection on the show too, and they say, no, it's not easy to beat it, unless you actually believe your lie.
No, it's actually easy to beat it with a system. I did a show on how to beat the lie detector test once, and we brought in this ex-cop who makes his living giving courses for mainly for defense attorneys and their clients on how to beat it. It's really easy to beat.
Is it now?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't give you the technique. Over
well,
the
why
air.
Not? I'd love to know.
Well, how? What you do is you spike the... you spike the readings on the normal questions, you know, is your name Art, you know, do you live in Nevada, you know, those kinds of questions, such that there's no difference between the normal questions, the norming questions versus the
and how, and what method do you use to spike
well, the best,
it?
The easiest, simplest way to spike, particularly the blood pressure. The blood pressure one is the most sensitive one. You can spike it. And you can spike it by squeezing your sphincter muscle when you give the answer to the normal question.
I'll be damned.
And that's what I said. When this guy told me that, I said, oh, come on, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this.
And
so I tried it, and I could spike my blood pressure by like 60 points in a matter of seconds just by squeezing your sphincter muscle while you give the answer. It's the most unbelievable thing, but it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. The lie detector test is not a reliable thing. It should not be used in court. Well, it isn't allowed to be used in court. And it shouldn't be because it's not reliable and it's easy to beat.
Well, I've heard some things on this program that would definitely spike your sphincter. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Shermer. Hello. Hello. Going once, going twice, gone. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Shermer. Hello. Hello there. Do we have a human or not?
Yes.
Yes, proceed. You're on the air.
Hello.
Got that part out of the way. Go ahead.
Yes, I got a question for the doctor.
Good.
What does he believe about John Edwards and the type of where he can contact the dead? I was kind of a skeptic about it for the longest time until my mom actually went to a reading. And at the end of the show, my mom did not have anything with her about what he was going to tell her. And all of a sudden he said, do you still have the flag from your grandpa's funeral? And there's no way he would have known that or anything.
Okay, look, that's a great question. It's very specific. There's several techniques at work. And first of all, as I mentioned earlier, anybody can talk to the dead. It's getting them to talk back. That's the hard part. And what are the techniques that they use to make it seem like they're doing that? It's called a cold reading technique and warm reading technique. Cold reading technique, you literally read somebody cold you've never met, throw out lots and lots and lots and lots of comments and questions, hundreds of them in a one-hour reading, dozens in a two-minute reading. And you see what sticks, and oftentimes you'll get one or two of these kinds of specific things. I wrote an article about this, How to Be a Psychic for a Day. There's a on our webpage, we have the techniques and the kinds of statements that you just made. There's hundreds of those that work really well with people, like the watch. He's telling me something about the watch. Turns out most men keep their dad's watch. Women, jewelry. The flag at the funeral, that's a common one. There's a whole list of these things that are true for general psychic readings. Like, I'm getting something about a scar on your left knee. Do you have a box of photos in your cupboard you've been meaning to put into a photo album? If it's a woman, you have an earring that you've lost the pair to, but you're hanging on to it in case you find it. Dozens of things like that are very successful. Not for everyone every time, but if you rattle off a couple dozen of those, you'll get three or four very specific, really weird hits, such that people like the caller will say, wow, it's incredible. I can't explain how he got X. Well, that's how you explain it, that they throw out a lot of things like that.
So from your point of view, nothing but frauds, psychologically well-armed frauds.
It's an act.
It's just all an act.
Yep.
There's nobody communicating.
Nope. Absolutely not. To me, there's no gray area in this one at all. It's pure fraud.
There is the what's the harm question, though, again.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, what's the harm of lying to people?
Well,
what's the
if
harm
somebody
of
is comforted.
In fraud? What's the harm of bank scams? Well, because it's a scam. It's wrong. It's immoral. It cheats people out of their money and their well-being and so on. It's wrong.
even if it's
lying totally and deceiving and fraudulently deceiving people out of their money is wrong. I don't care what the good benefits of it might be.
Technically and legally, you're correct. I'm not sure that you're morally correct. I'm not sure you're morally correct. I mean, if you are the other two, I'm not sure you're morally straight on there at all. To comfort somebody who has lost a loved one may be a life continuing act. Maybe. I'm Art Bell. Good morning. You're listening to Coast AM. Once again, Dr. Michael Shermer, I said it during the break, Doctor, to believe in nothing, literally, to be in doubt about virtually everything must be a very bleak, cold existence, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I don't. That's not me. I believe all sorts of things. I just try to base my beliefs on some sort of reason, rationality, science, or whatever. But scientists believe all kinds of things.
What do you
my
have,
worldview
what do you,
is anything but bleak. In fact, it's incredibly...
What do you have faith in?
Optimistic. What's that?
What do you have faith in?
Faith is not the word I like to use. I have confidence in certain things. Like the theory of evolution, for example, I have a high degree of confidence in that.
You do?
Because the evidence is so overwhelming.
But isn't there this missing link thing?
No, there are so many missing links, it's an embarrassment of riches. It's quite incredible how many transitional fossils we have now. Much better than it used to be.
Better, but not complete,
The theory is so well supported, not just the fossil evidence, but particularly the genetics now. The genetics is so detailed and so good that you can definitely see the lineage all the way back. It's very impressive.
Huh.
And here this is one of the best arguments against the alien stories that we hear. They look hominid. They're not going to be hominid. They're not going to look like us. They're not going to look like primates.
But doesn't the mere fact of our existence alone, our existence, the fact that we evolved however it happened, isn't that a good case for life being elsewhere?
There's a good case, I think, for bacterial-grade life being elsewhere.
I think
it's easy to get from nothing to something. I think it's much harder to get from something to us because of so many more steps between bacteria to big brains. I mean, you can get all the way up to Neanderthals and still have no...
It happened here. I mean, is it a miracle?
It's pretty damn unlikely to happen, yeah.
Would you say miracle?
It's a miracle if we define a miracle as, say, 1,000,000-to-1 odds. But if you have enough places to try it, it will happen.
But but here's where it happened, so...
Yeah, but wherever it happened, they're going to the people who it happened to are going to think, like the lotto winner, wow, what are the odds that I won?
So you think we're lotto winners. That's why we're here.
Yeah. There's just enough planets out there. There's so many planets.
Well, I know.
In my email,
they keep telling me I'm a lotto winner. So it must be, huh?
There you go.
First time caller line. Oh, don't give us your last name. Only your first name. That's one rule. Okay, so you're Tony?
This is Tony, and I'm calling from the island of Kauai, Hawaii.
Excellent.
And I have had numerous experiences since 1985 that I cannot explain. And it's caused me to actually read and study and try to understand.
What kind of experiences?
One of the experiences was it's completely drug-free. My body started billowing with smoke. Thank God... the person I was partnering with at that time was in bed with me, and I woke him up, and...
Are you telling me you began to ignite?
Not ignite. It was... smoke was coming off my body. It was not cold. This is in Southern California.
Yeah, but where there's smoke, there's... Right?
I know. And what I actually... and he witnessed it as well. And when it started happening, I began to do some research and wondering what was I keen off that I could actually see this. Is this something that actually exists that we don't really have the eyes to see? I've asked a lot of questions. Another situation that happened.
Let's stay with that one for a moment. did you ever get a picture of yourself smoking?
No, because it was a one-time event.
All right.
It never happened again. And like I said, it was drug-free.
I know what Dr. Shermer is going to say. But go ahead, Dr. Shermer, say it. Say it. I mean,
your psychic powers tell you. Well, I don't know, because I wasn't there. I mean, it's a one-time event. Those things are hard to explain. I guess what you're describing is something like spontaneous human combustion.
Sounded like it.
Usually, you know, there's some explanation. The person's a smoker and they fell asleep in bed smoking, something like that.
All right.
So that's a possibility. Maybe the guy she was with was a smoker. I don't know.
Maybe he set her on fire. All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Jean calling from Sacramento.
Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have a question for the guest about spiritualism.
Okay.
This is a religion that bases all their beliefs on scientific proof, and it's been in existence since the 1800s. I just wondered if he's familiar with that and what he thinks about that.
Do you mean like the Theosophical Society and Anthroposophy?
No, I mean the National Spiritualist Association of Churches.
They
one of their principles is they affirm the existence and personal identity of individuals after they die, and they also affirm that communication is possible through mediumship.
Uh-huh.
And there are
I'm familiar with that. Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
And there's physical phenomena. In fact, the religion strikes me. I've just been learning about it. It strikes me as a religion of skeptics because they're continually searching for proof and evidence.
Yep, that's good. However, I think the evidence for an afterlife and talking to the dead is very poor. Unfortunately, it would be nice if it were real. Love to believe in an afterlife. It'd be nice, but I just don't see it.
Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, you sound more like a spoiler than a skeptic at this point.
Well,
because
it's just the particular subjects we're dealing with here. There's a lot of room for skepticism, I guess you could say.
Well, I suppose it just seems that there seems.
I guess
to be...
I wish it was clear.
Well,
the evidence for God, for the afterlife, it's always this kind of fuzzy game that people have to play, like the mediums. They play this game and question and answers.
Well, in my experience with the spiritualist mediums that I've seen, who have not known me, by the way, at all, there were no questions. They spoke with an utter certainty, and the things were very specific and nothing common like you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
An example I'll give you is the first words with one reading was lemurs, which are, you know, little
monkeys.
Mm-hmm. And that had a meaning. They had no idea what that meant to me and how they would come.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, it has to do with a friend whose nephew had passed away, and he was very fond of lemurs.
Uh-huh.
And so what she was bringing was a communication that was the symbolism that he was there.
That is pretty obscure, but you would say, Doctor, what?
Right. Well, you're finding the meaning in the word. The psychic's not telling you what that meaning is. So you will see them say things like, red dress, I don't know what it means, what does it mean? And the person will then sit there and think for a minute and say, oh, I know that my beloved, before they passed over, they bought a red dress for my sister, you know, or something like that. So it's not the psychic telling the person getting the reading what the meaning is. It's the person getting the reading telling the psychic what it is. It's really a psychodrama where the person getting the reading, they're the ones really doing the reading, not the psychic.
All right. I would like to ask you to look inward a little bit, if you're able to do that, into the world of skeptics that you inhabit. Those who follow your very skeptical leadership. listen, I've interviewed a lot of them, and I must say it is not true of you. But most of the skeptics that I've interviewed are actually manic about it.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if you've noticed that trait in those that follow you, that there are many who are just, they actually do their cause more harm because of they're so manic about it.
Uh-huh.
You're not like that. So I wonder if you acknowledge that within, within your group of, believers.
Yeah, of course. All social movements have extremists on all ends. And, you know, born-again evangelical Christians, most of them are very thoughtful, nice people, and they're embarrassed by the abortion clinic bombers and extremists like that. Muslims are, most thoughtful Muslims are embarrassed by the extreme fundamentalists who,
so you would use that,
you know,
strong
fly
an
planes
analogy.
In the building. So, you know, every movement has that because we're human.
So you acknowledge it and you equate it to that level of embarrassment.
yeah, it can. Okay. Skeptics don't fly planes into buildings. You know, religion does that probably better than anybody else.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But it's really, again, skepticism is not a thing. It's not a noun. It's a verb. It's just, it's science.
It's a way of,
think of it as science.
It's a way of living. Yes, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer.
Hi, Dr. Shermer.
Hi.
Listen, you brought this up before about photons and through the slit. So I have a scientific question for you. What is your experience, or have you heard about recent scientific advancements in the lines of biophotons and how that relates to the light body?
I don't know anything about that.
The light body of human beings. And
okay, you don't know anything about biophotons, so either do I, for that matter. So what are they?
What are biophotons?
Right.
Biophotons, the science behind it is that it comes from your DNA, and it's like an antenna emitting and receiving photons.
We're back to quantum.
Well, he mentioned photons through the slit and that it might be crossing dimensions or universes.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if he was aware of it.
He is, and we talked about it, and he admitted what? How far can we go here? That there seemed to be some mysteries involved in it? Was that it?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know anything about biophotons.
Right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Art. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask a question concerning psychology. Considering the subjective philosophy behind the roots of it, is there any skepticism concerning his own profession?
Yeah, that's a great question. Should we be skeptical of the skeptics? Yep, you should be, absolutely. I mean, one of the beauties of science is that it has this built-in self-correcting machinery in which if you're not skeptical of your own claims, somebody else will be. In fact, they'll get bonus points for finding out where you went wrong. That's part of the system, and it's a pretty brutal, harsh system, the whole peer review system, where somebody's going to look for, specifically try to find where you screwed up and where you went wrong. That's the harsh part of science, but it's also its greatest strength.
Dr. Shermer, do you think you were born a skeptic, or do you think that your environment made you a skeptic?
Oh, I think more environment.
Really?
Just exposure to a driving curiosity myself, and then exposure to a lot of fraud and nonsense that I personally experienced, just trying all kinds of wacky things just to see what works.
Was there any moment when you had an epiphany and you just said suddenly, my God, I'm a skeptic.
Really more, my God, I'm a scientist, or I want to take a scientific perspective. And it wasn't a moment. It was a lot of moments. Really, in graduate school, I was taking a course on evolutionary theory that met Tuesday nights from 7 to 10. And then the class adjourned after that, went to the local bar, where we sat and had adult beverages and talked about you know, the Big Bang and God and religion and
so that's where you
the
figured it
life.
Out. Okay,
and that's where it happens. Really, over a 6-month period.
And
I'd say.
Also, I'd like to ask another question concerning intuition. You keep talking about psychics and mediums and that type of thing.
Yeah.
It would be totally subjective to assume any attribute within the human design. But why discount intuition altogether and support intellect so strongly?
Well,
intuition
you
is an important. Actually, there's a lot of really interesting research on intuition. Turns out, on many things, we're very intuitive. We're very accurate with our intuitions, and that particularly social relations, the ability to read emotions in people's faces, the sense of a situation being dangerous, that there's something wrong, the sense you have about another person's integrity, the quality of their character.
There's even studies, Doctor, that people can tell when they're being stared at. You heard about that?
Well, that's slightly different.
It's an intuitive. No, it isn't. It's an intuitive response.
Yeah.
So what do you think's going on there?
You mean with the stared at stuff?
Yeah,
I think what's going on with intuition in general is that we evolved in a social environment as well as a physical environment, and it was really important for our ancestors to be able to read social situations, be able to judge other people quickly, mm-hmm. be able to assess relationships between people.
Mm-hmm.
That's equally as powerful a part of our evolutionary history as is other things, the physical environment, for example. So I think we've developed good skills, intuitive skills at that sort of thing. And I think some people are better at it than others. So when we talk about women having more intuitive power than men, something like that, I don't think it's a secret, mysterious, paranormal power. I think it's just being tuned into your social environment, and women tend to be more tuned into the social environment than men are.
Mm.
I think there's something to intuition there.
Doctor, when you die, are you hoping you'll be surprised?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I think it'd be terrific.
What do you think?
No one's ever asked me that. Yeah, yeah. I would. I'm hoping I'll be surprised. Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
Trying to peel back the layers. That's all.
I like that.
Hoping to be surprised. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Shermer. Hello.
Yes, this is Jeff.
Yes, Jeff. I don't have a lot of time, so.
Okay, Dr. Shermer, this is kind of a broad question for you, but. On the aspects of mental illness and how, the people go through psychotic stages, hearing voices, and, they are a danger. Okay, they get locked up, they get on medication, and generally they're dealt with in a way, that just seems like, okay, you're mentally ill, you're touched. And
uh-huh.
It sounds like that's what some of the stuff is, and like in the Bible and stuff, like, people always say they talk to a spirit or they heard voices and, stuff like that. And I was just wondering your thoughts about, is there really cure in the, I'm not telling people to get off their meds or anything, but I'm saying, do you think there's the real cure for mental illness?
I think in the long run there will be. It's a very difficult problem. The meds are getting better. I think just doping people up is, is not great, but leaving them homeless on the street is also not great. as the drugs get better, they'll be able to be targeted for more specific things. And this is true for all diseases. Drugs for cancers and tumors.
Right. I want to plug your book because we're at the end of the show,
okay.
out of time and all that. It's The Science of Good and Evil, Why People Cheat, Gossip, Share, and Care, and follow the golden rule. Why should people buy this? Is it a good book?
Oh. Well, you're asking the author, yeah. It's the third of my trilogy. Why People Believe Weird Things was about science and pseudoscience. How We Believe was about science and religion. And The Science of Good and Evil is about the science of morality. So, it's all sort of a package of trying to set up a scientific worldview and live a life that is based on reason and science.
And the book will take you through all that. All right, listen, thank you so much, Doctor.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
You're a lot of fun to interview. Take care. That's Dr. Michael Shermer, and that is The Weekend. Boy, they go quickly. I'm Art Bell, and here's Crystal Gale. That's her last name. She's the one with just the right words to get us out of here. Listen carefully.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?